WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Last year's most controversial film was Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, but most people were in agreement that the film was beautifully shot by Ernest Dickerson. Dickerson was also the cinematographer on Spike Lee's two other features, She's Gotta Have It and School Days. His other credits include John Sayles' Brother from Another Planet, Crush Groove, the Eddie Murphy concert film Raw, and Peter Wong's new film Laser Man. I spoke with Dickerson about his collaborations with Spike Lee. He told me how they first met.
Well, we met in film school, our first year at New York University Graduate School of Film and Television. And although we really didn't work together in the first year because we were in two separate classes, you know, we talked and saw a lot of movies together and pretty much planned on working together as soon as we could, which was in second year of graduate school. Spike was a directing and a writing major, and I was a cinematography major. And we've worked together ever since.
Together with Spike Lee, you've made films about black people, with black actors, with largely black crews. Is it important to you to do that?
Well, yeah. Actually, the crews have been pretty much 50-50. Mm-hmm. They've been pretty integrated. Yeah, it is important for us, especially in the crews, because most of the time there's a lot of qualified black technicians who are mostly shut out when it comes to the crewing up process, for a lot of different reasons. We've found that, you know, people have come to town looking for, you know, black people to put on their crew, and for one reason or another, producers told them they couldn't find anybody, even though the town is full of them.
Were you ever worried about being shut out yourself?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's happened. I've gotten some pretty lame excuses for not hiring me. I've been told my work is too pretty. I was even turned down for a job one time because the producer wasn't sure if I could photograph a tree. That's what he told me. The film was taking place in the country. And most of what he had seen of my work was in, you know, in the urban environment. And he wasn't too sure if I could photograph a tree. Those were his words.
How long ago was this?
This was about 3-4 years ago. I still get shut out for various reasons. Sometimes the director wants me and sometimes the producer wants somebody else, and they'll tell the producer that I'm unavailable, they'll tell the director I'm unavailable, even though I am. So I've found that out several times, much to my dismay.
Mm-hmm. The movies that you've made with Spike Lee have also starred Spike Lee. What's the difference for you as the director of photography when Spike Lee is in the shot and when he's not in the shot?
Well, when he's in front of the camera, he needs an objective eye to kind of co-direct him through his performances and keep an eye on what he's not able to see because he's in front of the camera, and that's the job that I have. It puts a little bit more responsibility on me because I usually have to, you know, concentrate on performance as well. Spike does put a lot on me usually in terms of designing the look of the films and also designing entire sequences shot by shot. But when he's in front of the camera, then in a way I almost have to step into the director's chair for a few minutes.
Well, that must be really good for you. I mean, it's another challenge to take on.
Yeah, well, I like it. I mean, it's prevented me from just looking at any of his films as just a job. I mean, I get more involved than I imagine the average cinematographer might.
The first time you worked with him on camera, were you surprised at the amount of presence that he had, film presence?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing because it's the kind of thing you really don't see at first. When he first did that, it was on She's Gotta Have It. And he did it mainly because he couldn't afford anybody else. And we always thought of it as kind of a joke because Spike was the last person we thought we'd want to get in front of the camera. And then finally, after it was all over and we started seeing the film cut together, that's when we started seeing what was going on there, and he definitely stole the show. And a lot of people were surprised to know, find out that he was Spike Lee. Several times I saw it with an audience, and they knew that Spike Lee was in it, and they knew that Spike Lee directed it. And at the end, he shows all the actors, and they go through their, you know, they announce their names, their own names. And at the end, he says, Spike Lee, and everybody in the audience says, that's Spike Lee? It was kind of funny.
Did they think he'd be one of the taller, more conventionally good-looking guys in the film?
Yeah, I guess that most of them probably thought he was Tommy Hicks.
Mm-hmm. Your skills have grown as the budgets of your films have grown. Do the Right Thing was, I think, the first movie that you and Spike Lee did together that had a union crew. How does having a union crew affect your job and what you could depend on others to do and what you have to do yourself?
Well, actually, we did have a union crew on School Days, even though it was shot non-union in a right-to-work state, but most of the people were members of the NABUT local down there.
I see.
It's not so much the union crew, because there are a lot of good non-union crews in town. It was the money to give us more time to do things the way we really wanted to do them. If you don't have enough time to really perfect a shot or a sequence, a lot of times you're rushing and you get whatever you can in the time that you have. On Do the Right Thing, we had 10 weeks of shooting, which was very comfortable. And it enabled me to do a lot of things. I had more control over the image. If the light wasn't exactly right, we had time to wait for it, which was something I had always considered a luxury. Sometimes if the light wasn't right, I had time to build the light. I mean, there were several days where we had rainy days, and I had to make it look like sun. And doing something like that takes time, and we had the time to do that with. That's the thing that more money gives you.
How do you make a rainy day look like sun?
Well, I used a combination of brute arcs, which I still think is the closest approximation of sunlight. It's a big light. It's made by an arc that's passed between an electrical arc, a spark that's actually passed between two carbon rods. And it's the texture of the light is the closest to sunlight I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
There's one scene in the beginning of the movie where some folks are sitting on the stoop and they first meet Radio Raheem. What I did was to cover over the entire stoop area with big reflectors. And I bounced blue light into the white of the reflectors to simulate like blue light coming from a blue sky. And then with the arcs coming, simulating hard sunlight and just careful balancing it. I look at it today and I think it's one of the things I'm proudest about the film is that I was able to really achieve sunlight. It looks like sunlight, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're telling us that you work closely with Spike Lee in designing the look of a film. Can you talk a little bit about designing the look of Do the Right Thing?
Yeah. Well, long before Spike had the story nailed down, he told me he wanted to do something that took place on the hottest day of the year. He wanted to highlight the fact that he had read that the murder rate rises on very hot days, that on hot days the tempers are short, nerves afraid, people are like very nervous, the heat just like aggravates the smallest thing. And he wanted to, you know, he wanted to convey that visually, and he talked to me about ways of doing it. What I figured was that we had to limit the color scale, stay away from cool colors, really hone in more on the yellows and reds, the warm part of the spectrum, and also play with various degrees of overexposure to get the feeling of glare, mm-hmm. You know, especially at midday. Also, since the script took place in one day, I also had to show how the light changes in the course of the day. The light goes from very low in the sky in the morning, you know, usually a warmer light, to very glary, hard, hot light at midday, and then back into like a warmer, softer, redder light at the end of the day.
I want to ask you a question about the most controversial scene in the movie, and this is the scene where Danny Aiello breaks Radio Raheem's boombox, and the fight that they're having becomes, you know, erupts into a riot. From everything I've read about the making of the film, Danny Aiello didn't like the way that scene was initially written and didn't much like the way his role was written, and he expanded on it. He put in a lot more biography about the character and everything. During the period when he and Spike Lee were discussing how this character should be and how that scene should be played out, where were you? Did you participate in that discussion, or did you just kind of keep away until that's resolved between director and actor?
Yeah, that's a very personal conversation between director and actor. Spike and Danny worked that out between themselves in rehearsals and all their conferences, talking about who the character is and where he goes, how he develops. I'm not usually privy to that. But a lot of times I see it happening on the set, and sometimes, you know, an actor will ask me a second opinion about what I'm seeing.
Now, you just wrapped a film. The film's initial title was Love Supreme. I don't really know what it's being called now.
It's called The Mo Better Blues.
And it stars, I believe, Denzel Washington as a jazz musician.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just fill us in a little bit more on what the basic premise of the movie is?
Basic premise is, I think it's a dilemma that a lot of artists go through. When your devotion to your art gets in the way of your personal life, and vice versa. He's a trumpeter. He's devoted to his music. He makes no bones about telling the two ladies in his life that his music comes first. And naturally, they have problems with that.
Now, how did you prepare to shoot this movie?
One of the things that we did, spent a lot of time with the art director, as usual. I think it's very important to have a good rapport with a production designer, because he's the guy or the girl that's going to put the put those things out there that you're going to photograph. I always work with him to discuss the colors that are being used in the sets. I believe in controlling color and controlling the palette of the film. You discuss lighting in locations and things like that. An example is there's a major set that was built is called the Club Underdog. And one of the things I worked out with him was letting the club light itself as much as possible, so that when we went in, most of the work was already, or most of the lighting was already integrated into the design of the club. And, you know, it's things like this that help you get the look of a film. You really have to work closely with a production designer and the costume designer.
Since this film is about a jazz musician, did you go back and watch any classic jazz films?
No classic jazz films. We looked at a lot of jazz photography, especially of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. We went through a lot of books. There was a book that I've had for years. It's a book called Jazz Street by a photographer named Dennis Stock. And it's all black and white. Photographs of jazz musicians backstage, at work, even portraits, documentary-type stuff in clubs. I mean, really beautiful photography. And I looked at that quite a bit to give me an inspiration for the feeling of the club and different musical numbers.
So what point are you right now in making this new film?
Mo Better Blues is currently in the editing stages.
Are you in on that?
No. Well, I come in at the end after it's all cut together, and I do what's called the final color grading, which is I supervise the master of what is going to be the template for the release prints. And that's making sure that all the colors, all the brightnesses or the darknesses, the shadings that I went for in the lighting make it to the final print.
Is it typical for a cinematographer to have that control at the end of the process?
Yeah, it should be. Most of the time, I am able to do that. I have it written into my contract. That's just to ensure that my work makes it to the screen the way it should be. There have been a couple of times when I've been shut out, or the producers just didn't schedule it. A lot of times producers don't want to bring a cinematographer in for reasons of their own. I mean, sometimes they think it's going to cost them more money. A lot of cinematographers would do it for free just to make sure that their work makes it to the screen intact.
Mm-hmm. When you were back in school and you were learning about film lighting, were a lot of the lighting techniques that you were taught really designed to light white skin, white faces?
Yeah. The whole exposure system is based around Caucasian tone. But before I went to film school, I studied still photography. I minored in color photographic illustration at Howard University. And most of the models that I photographed were black. So even then, I had started working out my own methods, my own exposure methods for black folks.
How different is it?
I don't feel it's that different, probably because it's, I think it's become second nature to me now. It's basically placing the values, the skin, the tonal values, where I want them. It's also a combination of makeup also, because one of the things you don't want to do is dull black skin too much, especially dark skin, because you cut down its reflectivity if you do that. So actually a light moisturizer in the skin is usually required, and I usually talk that over with the makeup person.
Mm-hmm. Any other different considerations?
It depends upon the situation. It depends upon if the black actor is in the same scene with a white actor. Sometimes that can be problematical because if you have to put a little bit more light on the black actor, then it'll burn out the white actor. So sometimes it comes into using nets to just shade and try and achieve a balance between the two.
Earlier in our conversation, you said that you thought that there was a time when you were shut out, that you weren't given offers that you thought you perhaps would have been given had you not been black. Do you still feel that way? I mean, your films are really getting very well known and are very successful. Do you still feel that you're being shut out from certain films?
Well, I'm not turning down work yet.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, I interview for projects that I think I'm ideal for. And usually I'm given an indication that they'd really like to use my services, but a lot of the times I'm not used. So I get that. I mean, I've gotten two turn downs in the past 2 weeks, but then I get calls from people that you know, insist that I shoot their production. So it goes both ways.
Well, I wish you the best with your new films, and I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Cinematographer Ernest Dickerson. His new films include Peter Wong's Laser Man and Spike Lee's upcoming film, Mo' Better Blues.